Friends, today we're talking to Pastor Amy Walter Peterson, and I think I've said this before, but this is next level wide-ranging conversation, because we talk about grief, we talk about the cyclicality of life, we talk about the lessons we would give ourselves if we could go back in time, and then how those lessons approach what we're doing today. We talk about just how our desire for what is known might be in conflict to what is best for us and how we want to evolve and learn. And we talk about Jesus, and it's a beautiful conversation. I'm excited for you to listen to it. Let's get into it. Pastor Amy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you again.
So we chatted back at the end of November, right before the Christmas holiday. And it's
yes,
perfect, because now we're chatting pretty close to Easter, another one of these kind of mile markers in our calendar.
It's true.
How have you been?
Ah, that's a big question. I have been good in general. I have had a good Christmas. My winter has been good. It has been marked, sadly, by the death of a friend of mine. And that has just been its own journey of grief, and but also a time of memory. And so that's been really present in this season as well for me.
The presence of grief, it's like this thing that just gets added on top, and then it just stays there.
Yes.
How are you doing with the honoring that, honoring what's true about all that's contained in this mixture of emotions and feelings of grief, and still holding space for life?
I believe that every death connects with every other death. And I am aware that as a pastor, I have a lot more practice, perhaps, than some people in encountering death and continuing and holding space for that grief while also living and going through daily life. And so I think because I have the opportunity to practice that a lot, my experience may be a little bit different than other people's. I think it's also true that I try to pay attention to when the feelings are coming out, whether those feelings are the joy that's coming out or the grief that is coming out in brain fog, or when there are other signs that I see that the grief is trying to work its way out of me, I try to pay attention to that. I try to take time for that, whether that means an extra walk or a workout or just some time apart in quiet. I try to pay attention to that so that it gets attended to and doesn't just get shoved. And then also just continuing to live life around those moments when it emerges. I guess that's how I would answer that question.
I appreciate that, because you do have a different vantage point than a lot of people, but it's still very actionable.
Yes. And I also have some strategies. I have had to learn some strategies, just very practical strategies of how to maintain my composure in the midst of times when those emotions are emerging, because I'm in a leadership role or because other people are looking to me in that moment to be a calm, peace-filled presence for others so that they can do their work of grief. And so I have some strategies that I've developed over time that I draw on sometimes, but I try to be really aware when I'm drawing on those strategies so that I then also give myself time to feel the feeling that I have been strategizing around in those moments.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, people often laugh, but one of my strategies is when I find myself approaching getting teary, especially if I'm in a leadership role, I start to think about something like football or hockey or something that has nothing to do with the moment, because it's the thinking about the moment and thinking about the emotion that I'm feeling if I'm talking about someone or whatever it is that I'm doing. That's what brings the externalizing of the tears. So that's just one strategy, is I just try to think about something about as far away and unemotional as I can in that moment. And that really helps me to just regain my composure. And also taking time, if I sometimes feel those tears, taking a moment to breathe, to sip some water, that can also be just a helpful strategy to regain my grounding.
I think a lot of us have hats that we wear that we recognize we're leading the pack, whether that's you're doing it in church and you do it with your friends and you do it with your family circle, like you do it in all of these places. I see myself doing it with my team, with my family, with my children in particular. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, and this is not anywhere you and I talked about going, so this is so interesting to me. Whenever the record button goes on, we have no idea where this is taking us today. I notice that if I have nail marks in my palm, you might be holding on a little too tightly.
Yeah.
In your leading. And I put leading in quotation marks there.
Sure.
I think it's easier to be there than to be in the feeling part.
Yes, it is easy to be in the leading part than in the feeling part, for sure. I read in the midst of the pandemic the book by the Nagoski sisters, Burnout. I can't remember their names, but it's a really wonderful book. And one of the things that I took away from reading that book was how essential, this is their language, metabolizing our feelings is to our just mental health and our ability to keep leading, keep doing, keep working. And so that book was really helpful. And in the midst of the pandemic, that book was really eye-opening. And I learned a whole lot about just how our bodies hold emotion, how our bodies need to process emotion, and the kind of agony and the pain that we create for ourselves when we don't do that metabolizing of emotion. And so that has been a really helpful learning for me in my ministry, that in those times when I don't give in to the feeling, that I then need to give myself time to still do that work. Because if all I do is don't give in to the feeling and keep shoving it and shoving it, it will come out in all kinds of really physically painful ways in my body, or other painful ways where I'm lashing out or just being hurtful. And that's not how I want to live.
I think that we all have our strategies for how we do push it down in the moments where it would be mm-hmm. inconvenient or wrong or not a good look for us to have the big mm-hmm. feelings. Like, we all have our strategies. And I think it's the awareness that you're leveraging them that also creates the invitation for you to be like, oh, I'm going to have to feel that. Like, I did a lot of football thing today. I thought a lot mm-hmm. about tight ends and centers and special teams.
Yep.
And so I'm going to have to really give myself something on the other end of this, because I thought about a lot of football today.
Yep.
And there's something nice about the intentionality of that strategy giving you a very aware stance.
Yes. And yes, I think that is very true. And I am also aware of that there are also times that I'm just suppressing the feeling and I don't even know that I'm doing it. And being more intentional about things like exercising, which is one of the ways that we metabolize, just giving myself that space and time, I've become more aware of how essential that is, because I'm not always aware of where that suppression is happening.
I'm always surprised when I move and I cry. I've become very aware that anytime I move my body and there are tears that come up, and not because like I'm in pain, it's, oh wow, you really let a lot simmer there. Like the other night I was dancing like an absolute 5-year-old in the kitchen with Leora. My objective was to bring as much energy and mirroring of her move to myself as I could. And I recognized like how free she is and how big she allowed her body to be. And like, I'm sobbing and laughing. It's like sobbing, laughing. And it's like giddy. And it's, oh, wow, you had a lot in there over the last few weeks. The holidays had a lot of energy. And so you had a lot. And so you moved and that happened.
And there's nothing like mirroring the movement of a child to point out to us adults how constrained we have become. That's just, I think any mirroring of a child is a lesson to all of us, that the ways that we are taught is to tighten up, to become constrained, to just pull it all in. And kids aren't worried about that.
Yeah. I heard so much sit like a lady as a girl that, that's real.
Yeah, it is real.
Take us back. Because now we've gone down a few big rabbit holes together. And I don't know that anybody knows you as much as I hope that we get to know you. So tell us a little bit about you.
I am a pastor. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I have been a Lutheran pastor for 20 years. I celebrated my 20th anniversary of ordination this past summer. I grew up in Minnesota, which you might be able to hear, but my upbringing in Minnesota and the first 30 years of my life that I spent there really significantly shaped who I am and how I see the world. People have a lot of impressions of what Minnesota is and what it represents. What it represents for me is a really accepting, expansive kind of way of viewing people and viewing the world. And so that was just really rooted in me from a really young age. I said I'm a Lutheran pastor, and that while I consider my faith identity primarily as a Christian, growing up in a Lutheran Christian tradition really shaped who I am also and how I see the world. I went to Lutheran churches from the time I was a baby. I went to a Lutheran college in Minnesota, which is called St. Olaf, which many people know of because of the St. Olaf Choir. I sang in the St. Olaf Choir. Singing was the first thing that I loved in this world and all I ever wanted to do when I was a little kid. And so being a part of Lutheran churches, being a part of Lutheran communities, going to a Lutheran college, like all of that really shaped my identity, my understanding, and my view of the world. So it's a really big part of who I am and how I just live in the world.
What does it mean to you to be Christian and then to be Lutheran?
I think being Christian is the most important of those two questions. I'm just going to say that because Christian encompasses all ways of understanding Christian faith. And so that is the supreme. For me, being a Christian means being a follower of Jesus, the Jesus that is made known through scripture, through the Bible. It means seeking to know him, seeking to be in relationship with him, and seeking to become, to use a word I used recently in a sermon, become entangled with him and with other people that are seeking to know who he is in this world. And bringing our lives and coming alongside others. That's what it means to me to be a Christian. To be a Lutheran Christian is, I think, to have a particular way of seeing how Jesus acts in the world as always seeing Jesus as the one who reaches out to us. As a Lutheran Christian, I believe that there is nothing that I can do, nothing I can do to earn God's love, but that love has been made known to me through Jesus, and that God's love is continually is reaching out to connect with me, to know me, to tell me I'm enough, and to give me a sense of my okayness, despite my humanity, and despite all the ways that I'm not okay, Jesus makes me okay. And so that's what it means to me to be a Lutheran Christian. And I think that's a particular way that Lutheran Christians see the world.
Stepping into conversations that are not first date appropriate, it's tricky. And I think a lot of people have identified their relationship with religion, spirituality as complicated. And whenever I hear you talk about it, it feels really simple in the best way possible. Simple in that it's not, your belief feels all in.
I think that my belief in Jesus is all in. I think that in Jesus, we see God's love for the cosmos in flesh. When I study the Gospels, I see that love continually trying to break barriers, trying to connect, trying to bring wholeness and healing and abundance to all of this world, to all of this world. And I am all in on that. No questions. I am not always all in on the ways that people, churches, institutions, denominations try to limit and put barriers to that, but I'm all in on Jesus. And I have become more and more clear about that over the last 20 years. I don't know that I would always say that as clearly as I do now. But for sure, at this point in my life, I am all in on Jesus.
How does one, this obviously gets edited because I've got a lot of long pauses here because I'm trying to pick my words thoughtfully. So feel free to be like, I'm going to take that again if you want to. Not, there was nothing that you've said that I was like, we should take that again. But I want to point out the piece that you said there about where you're all in and also where you're not. Because I think that today we seek institutions and individuals to be in perfect alignment with our own ideal, or we decide that must not be for us. And I think that belief, like, I don't believe in everything that they're talking about, or this perception or misperception about, oh, this is what it means to go to Lutheran church, this is what it means to go to Catholic church, this is what it, like, all of this, like, there's so much underlying current belief there. How do we show up in places where we're not in agreement?
I don't know how we show up. What I can say is that part of what helps me show up is related to my understanding of the world. And that is that I am really aware that despite all that God intends for us, and despite my best efforts, I am on a daily basis gonna fail to live in oneness with the creator of the world. I can't help it. That's what it means for me to be human. And so I can't help but live that way on a daily basis. And all of the people around me can't help but live that way on a daily basis. And so the organizations and institutions that we're a part of are going to reflect who we are as well. So I have a pretty clear understanding that the organizations and the institutions that I choose to give my energy and time to are going to end up looking like me. And so that, I think, gives me some grace to say that it reflects who I am. And so, of course, it's not going to reflect everything I long for it to be, because I don't even reflect everything that I long to be. That's just the reality. And so I try to keep that really forefront in my own thinking when I get discouraged by institutions. And I try to choose those organizations and institutions where I want to really show up and do my best work and give my best self, even though I know it's never going to be everything that I am capable of doing, in hopes that those organizations, institutions, in my case, the church, will look a little bit more like what I hope God intends for this world. But I'm really aware that at the end of the day, everything is just going to be an approximation.
Yeah.
And so I guess it's not a question that I ask a lot, because I have such a clear understanding about this world that we're living in.
Yeah. You mentioned singing. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, and I think we forget that a lot. I think that we forget sometimes that organizations and institutions are made of people. They're not something apart from people and the people that are a part of them. So of course they're not going to look perfect.
Yeah. Haven't met a perfect one yet.
Yeah, me neither.
I saw a very funny meme the other day that I can't unsee in my brain. And it's, do you think the clouds are up there looking down at us saying, hey, that one looks like a moron? In the same way that, like, we look at the clouds and we're like, hey, it looks like a dragon. And it's like that. I just love, I don't yes. know exactly how connected that is to what we were just talking about, but it feels right in alignment.
Oh, it feels right on, right in line.
Yeah. You mentioned singing in the choir for St. Ola. What was that like?
It was really a phenomenal experience as a young person. I sang in the St. Olaf Choir for 3 years. It was an exercise in discipline and excellence that I have never equaled, probably at any point in my life. We rehearsed 5 days a week, 7 hours a week throughout the school year. It was like being in a sports team. I'm not, like, music is big business. It's like serious business at St. Olaf. And so being a part of one of the touring ensembles was a huge time commitment. It was, for me, absolutely foundational also to my faith, because before I studied scripture, I sang sacred music. And so sacred music planted itself in my heart and in my soul from the time I was a young person, like 3 years old, singing in church choir. And I mean, it was a phenomenal learning experience, just learning what I was capable of. And I think the other thing about singing in a group like the St. Olaf Choir that was, for me, life-giving, was that I'm a person that grew up being affirmed for having a beautiful voice, but no matter how well I sang individually, I would never be able to create the sound of a choir by myself. And so it was absolutely an opportunity to be a part of something bigger than myself and contributing to that in really tangible ways, but daily hearing the evidence of what it means to be part of something bigger than yourself.
If you could go back and tell yourself something day one, what would you say?
I think I would say, take it all in. Because when I started singing in the choir, I was so scared. I was a little scared of making a mistake. I was really scared of just not being able to contribute enough. And I think I would tell myself, just take it all in and just dive in.
How does that same advice apply to where you're taking best next step action today?
I think I have a tendency to put my toes in. I'm not a diver inner. I wade in and see how it is, and maybe I'll back up if I need to. And there's a lot of ways that has served me really well. But I do think that there are some times that I miss out from really experiencing things because I just don't dive in. I'm afraid I'm not going to do it right, or I'm afraid that I'm not going to be up to whatever it is that emerges. So I think that's a lesson that I still have to learn in my life.
That's a relatively new question that I've been adding for a few episodes now. And I think it is so interesting, like each of the guests that have had a pivotal moment, like they had an experience, like Christine Wayne talked about getting sober. Bernard Tony talks about deciding to enlist in the military while holding his friend who was dying in his arms from gunshot wounds. Like, we hear these people, and I ask, what is the advice you would give yourself then? And almost always that advice is like that thread of life lesson that we are learning at a new vantage point over and over again. I think I'm so curious about that. Like, I find myself really interested in what is that? And how's it shown up? And
I think it's interesting because I have been trying to carry a mantra for a while now. And I think it relates actually, and I've never made this connection before, but the mantra that I have been trying to carry is, I have to be bad at something if I want to be good at something. Especially if I'm learning something, I have to be willing to do it badly in order to figure out how to do it well. And I think that there is a piece about diving in that is about doing it badly. Because if we're not willing to do it badly, we're just never going to, there's no growth, there's no progression, there's no movement. And I think those two things are related.
My kind of guiding intention for this season was willing and curious. Like, in this moment, I choose to be willing and curious. And that feels, yeah, we're right in this together.
Yeah.
It is vulnerable to be willing, especially for people that have eyeballs on them. And that's you for sure. Like, there are people that are like, oh, I'm watching what this person is doing. They're a leader. And to be willing is to be vulnerable.
One of the places where I am trying to be willing and curious, or in my language, like where I'm trying to be bad at something so I can get good at something. Right before the pandemic started, the beginning of January of 2020, I really wanted to move towards being an extemporaneous preacher. And so I was working really hard.
What does that mean?
Oh, it means like preaching without a manuscript.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to be able to preach a sermon without like reading or having developed a manuscript first. And I do that in some instances, but I don't do it consistently. I've never done it on a consistent week in, week out basis. And right before the pandemic started, I was like, I'm going to become, 2020 is the year I'm going to become a preacher who doesn't work for manuscripts. And so I started it. I was working so hard at like, how do I develop an outline, or what's the strategy, or how do I even develop a sermon so that I can get to this point? Because it's got different skills involved in how you even do your work to get to that point. And then the darn pandemic just blew all of that out. And so I went back to manuscripts because it's what I knew, and everything was so hard, and that was not hard. So I could at least do that. But I'm working again this year. I've circled back and said, all right, this is, I got to work on this again. So I'm trying again. And I'm really aware that what keeps me from doing that is that it's hard and I'm not very good at it. And so I'm going to have to be bad at it if I'm going to ever get good at it. And so that has been the place where I'm trying to put that to work in my own life.
Do you know of anyone that is good at it?
Probably do. The problem with being a pastor is that I don't always take the time to actually notice and listen to how other people preach. And so I don't always know who those people are. But if I did some digging, I would know who's good at that and I could learn some things from them.
I find being inspired by how somebody else has done something gives me permission to like try it on. It's Instagram fashion in a lot of ways where I'm like, oh, look it. See, she's just wearing a black turtleneck and she's fine. She doesn't feel like she needs to style it. She's not wearing a belt. But I now have permission to just wear the black turtleneck and not wear a belt. And this feels incredible.
Yes.
But I always think that there's something there. And who's doing it? Why do I even want this? Why are you willing to be bad at it to be good at it? What does it mean to be good at it?
I think the reason I want to be good at it is because I do think that there is something about an openness to the movement of the Spirit in the moment that when I've done my work beyond what is visible on a manuscript, when I have done my reading and my studying and my thinking and my outlining and all of those things, when I've done all that work, when I've known here is the kind of movement I want to make through today's sermon, here are the illustrations or the points that I'm going to make along the way, and I feel comfortable and confident in that, what I know is that there is also a space that opens up in that for the Holy Spirit to speak in that moment in a way that is beyond anything I could have imagined. And that is what I want. That is what I want both to experience, what I want my congregation to be able to experience. And I want so much to be open to that. Yeah, I want to be open to that. And I'm aware that the work of writing, I absolutely believe that the work of developing a sermon manuscript also means that the Holy Spirit is work. It's not that I'm saying that the Holy Spirit is present in one and not the other. But I want in the moment of preaching to be open and available to the work of the Spirit in a way that I don't always feel like I am when I have a manuscript in front of me.
Do you always sing to music?
Do I always sing to music?
Yeah. Do you always sing what's been written for you?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I generally do sing to music. It has been one of the things that I have wanted to do is to do some more voice study around extemporaneous singing, more kind of standard and jazz. I've not studied that a lot. Most of my vocal study in my life has been classical and operatic. And so I think the two are related. I actually am aware that those two are related.
It feels like there's an openness and a curiosity around that exploration.
Yes. I have not put it away and just said that was the idea of 2020 and the time passed. And so I'm going to just forget that. I've not put it away. It still is a yearning and maybe it's even just a personal challenge that I have for myself, but it's still an area, I think, of growth that lies ahead of me that I really want to explore.
You are not the first person that I've spoken to this week that has talked about something that we put away in 2020 coming back up now. Amidst the start of COVID, I had four very little children, essentially. And I watched everybody make their sourdough starters and attempted to start with the sourdough starter. And at day four, when it blew up all over our dining room table, because that's what happened, I was like, I will buy some sourdough from Wegmans. And I cleaned out the jar. But it's been in the back of my mind for all this time at some level of, oh, I didn't do that thing that I was actually very curious about.
Yeah.
And 12 days ago, I was like, I'm going to just start and see. And today, for the first time, my starter floated. And so I have a loaf that's proofing right now. And I suspect that this will be the worst sourdough I've ever had in my life. And I have every intention of making everybody eat it and celebrate it for the worst sourdough. Like, because I know that this is a process and this takes time. But there's something, I think there's something cyclically happening for us to say, oh, you're now in a space where you can reconsider this thing that was there for you 4 years ago. Now it might be here for you in the right time.
I think you're right about that. I think people had all kinds of different experiences of living through, and this, especially the start of the pandemic, and the ways that their lives changed and adapted and were altered by that. And I think as the pandemic went on, there was like the initial upheaval. And then there was like, all right, how am I going to endure? And then there was like starting to emerge. I'm coming out again of this. But all of that is cyclical. None of it is linear. So you're always taking one step forward and two steps back and three steps forward. And it's a squiggle. It's not a straight line. But I think that in that, there are moments when we come back to that place. I have often said to my congregation and people that I know that the short or the longest distance between two points is a straight line. I really do believe that the squiggle is the life. And that those squiggles are going to bring us back to that point again. And so, yeah, I think that's true. I think that is what we're experiencing.
Yeah. That's where you're taking your best next step energy, is in this exploration of these.
Yeah.
That's exciting. When you think about the breakdown of it, because we know that this objective is not like, it's not going to happen on Sunday where you're going to be like, oh, I did that. That was great. Well done. Like, what's the tiny micro action that's helping to steer the ship?
I think one of the tiny micro actions is, it may seem really strange, but one of the tiny micro actions that I actually took last fall to move in this direction was I bought a big black notebook that has no lines in it. And that is where I start to do my weekly musing in. I would always start my week previously on my computer screen. I would set up my document in a very particular way for each Sunday. And then I would start doing my work and adding notes to my computer. And what I realized in my learning was that opening the doc was like half of the problem, because if I opened the doc, it was so easy to go from, well, here are my notes, I'm just going to put them in order. And pretty soon I was writing a sermon, like writing a manuscript, even if I didn't want to, even if I didn't have an intention. It was just the fact that I had opened a doc and saved a doc and started it. It was just easier to do that. And so one of my micro steps was just to buy a black notebook without any lines. And that is where I start my work.
I have chills right now because there's so many connection points to previous episodes now on approach and how if we want a different outcome, starting somewhere new is important. Because if we, our neural pathways are already present, like, your brain is looking for the fastest route out of the maze.
Yes.
And it knows it because you've given it. And this new route is not going to be faster. It might be a lot harder. It's going to challenge you in ways that you can't even predict. And so, of course, we have to start differently if we want a different outcome. I think it's why, not in a named way, but I think it's why so many systems and everything are like, what's your morning routine? Let's reframe that, because how you start matters. Because if you just start off and you take the same route to work, you're going to go the same way to work that you've always gone to work.
Yes.
I want to just hold a pause here for the listeners who are having the same moment that I'm having right now, where you're like, oh, I say I want a different outcome, but then I do the same things. That might apply to these 17,000 things in our life that we have low-level nag complaint style feedback about.
I think also, I know for myself, because I think that idea of how do I approach something has to change if I want the end result to change. I think I've become more aware of that maybe in the last year. And my learning style is I tend to stumble into something. Like, I'm not someone who like learns and then practices. I'm someone who like does, and then I realize what it is that I'm doing. I think I've been that way my whole life, and I'm comfortable with that. But I have been trying to do that same thing in other parts of my life too, is just, what's the micro thing that I can do different? If I want a different outcome, what is the micro thing that I can do different that might at least start me in a slightly different direction? I'm not even talking about 10 degrees. It might be 0.10 degrees that's a different, but it's going to, maybe that's just enough to get me moving in a different trajectory. Because as you say, like the tracks, like the way I like to think about it is the train tracks. The train tracks are so beautifully laid. They're so efficient. They're so just easy to get the momentum going. And so I just like figuring out, how do I just, what's a micro way that I can just get on a different trajectory?
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful place to close. Because we're all on our own journeys, and we're all headed to the same end. The squiggle is different.
Yeah, the squiggle is different. And the squiggle is, for me, the squiggle is the journey. That's what it's all about. Yes, I want a straight line. I love the efficiency of a straight line. I'm enough of a, in the Myers-Briggs, a J, that I just, you know, I just want it easy and fast and straight. I love that. Makes my heart go pitter patter. But life is so much more interesting in the squiggle.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on today again. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. This is a fun conversation.